Radio's coverage of AusCert's 2008 conference is sponsored by Microsoft. Visit itradio.com.au/AusCert08 for IT Radio's full coverage of this year's event and to hear Microsoft's AusCert presentations. Or go to itradio.com.au/security for the Risky Business podcast, honing your eardrums since February 2007.
Welcome to this special audio presentation from AusCert. In the following presentation, you'll hear Colin Whittaker, the head of security for APACS, the UK Payments Association, talking about whether biometrics are really ready for use in banking and payments. Enjoy.
Identity-based issues, and you cannot separate biometrics from the whole issue of the fundamental basis of what is identity, either in the face-to-face space, which is where biometrics comes in, or on the online space. And one of the things we've been involved with is supporting the UK government in the National ID Card program, and I'll say a few words about why we are supporters of that towards the end when I look at one of the scenarios. Just at the bottom line, there's some of our members, some major financial institutions of the world, and we sort of got someone from down south as one of our members as well. They bought out a couple of the UK mid-sized banks, and they're a very active member on all of our committees and groups, and they're very useful to have around the table. But everyone else there, from main high street names like Barclays and HSBC and Nationwide, all the way through to some big other names from around the world. Okay, first of all, define my terms. Always important. What is the basis of my assumption and what am I talking about? I'm talking about biometrics, so what do I mean? Well, biometrics, what are they? They are the biological footprints that we carry around with us. And I have to say right at the start, a lot of the stuff I'm going to say actually is going to reiterate some of the stuff that Scott said yesterday and actually what Bill said this morning. So a bit of my powder has been stolen by them. And one of the things I wanted to make, because Bill made it this morning, about DNA being shed everywhere, well, that's the same with all biometrics, apart from really two classes of biometrics that aren't surface-based that you leave lying around in one form or another. One is vein recognition, which you can either do on the fingers or the palms, which are being developed by two competing companies, Hitachi and the other one. I can't remember who's doing the other one. And the other one being, of course, retinal scanning, which is, means you have to get into the back of the eye. Everything else is surface-based, and you can capture if you want to as an adversary. And all the famous ones are there, fingerprints, iris, face, and voice, which I'll be talking about some detail later on. What about terms? When you're talking about biometrics, you have to go back to the basics of how we do identity and verification and what they actually mean. Now, identification is the classic one-to-many scenario. I don't know you, or you might exist in a whole pool of potential candidates, and can I pick you out from that candidate? It's the one-to-many space. Whereas verification is the one-to-one space. I am making some positive assertions about who I am, and you have to verify whether those assertions are true or not. And those often get mixed up. When soon as people start talking about biometrics, they actually start saying, they actually lend you to believe they're talking about identification, where actually they're talking about the verification paradigm, or vice versa. So I think it's absolutely important to actually understand what you're talking about. We're talking about identification being much more significant in the registration and enrollment paradigm, for my industry particularly, and the verification is what happens at that point of use. In other words, for example, when I bring the debit or credit card to the shop to pay, how can I assert who I am? And those are important categories that you need to recognize. And finally, the bit at the bottom, matching. You will have heard of false rejects, false positives, all those sorts of terms. Actually, in the vogue these days in biometrics are these two terms, false match and false non-match. And I think they're much more to-the-point definitions. The false match being, oops, you let the bad guy through, and false non-match, oops, you've rejected the customer. And there's one thing the banks do not want to do is reject the genuine customer because you're going to annoy someone who's got a bank account with you and they may take their bank account elsewhere. Okay, why would we be interested at all and what benefit can we get from them? Well, first of all, banks have an obligation under law in UK to know their customer. It's known as the KYC requirements. And it's being enshrined in lots of other duties of care around the world as well. We need to do that in the bank branch when someone comes in a shop when they're offering a payment credential of some form, be it a check or a plastic card, whatever that might be. We need to do it online as well when you're registering for online banking. We need to prove who that person is. And really, that's where the true problems exist. The real big problem is how do you do it with a huge population of users that you have got as potential customers? I'm not going to be talking about biometrics in this space at the bottom there. Biometrics in that space is the classic internal security aspects of how a bank manages its own organization and what duties and controls it puts in place to help manage what its members of staff are doing. And I have seen myself in a variety of cases where biometrics are starting to be used, particularly in the protection of cryptographic assets. A lot of places which have got really high-end PKI CA-type factories, you will see those being protected by high-end biometric controls. Whereas up here, we're talking about the consumer space, the customer space. How do we deal with the customer out there and what biometrics do we need to use? And that's what's interesting. It's been particularly interesting for my industry for a very good reason, which I will talk about next. And that is there life after PIN? Now, many of you will know that the UK was one of the lead countries adopting what was called chip and PIN technology, replacing the mag stripe on your payment cards, your debit cards, your credit cards, with chips inside them. And by that, I should say right at the for those other people in the audience who might say, well, we weren't in UK. What I mean by we were the leaders using what was the common standard, which is known as the EMV standard, which stands for Europay, MasterCard and Visa, which is the global interoperable standard for smart cards. And we were certainly leading the way in that standard. And we have a standing question that we are trying to answer and review periodically. And that's basically, where do we go from after using PIN? And the logical where we go after is biometrics, because the PIN gives us a two-factor form of authentication. And the only place we can go after that is three factors. So if we don't have PIN, what do we use? And I've been monitoring biometrics with my team for about the last 3-4 years now and helping to frame an answer to this question. But let's look at what we get from chip and PIN first of all, because the chip is an important capability. It offers a secure receptacle for very sensitive data like PINs, cryptographic keys, and it's got some sensitive counters on it as well, which we use to control the behavior of the rest of the card. It is a two-factor solution. It is something you have as well as something you know, the something you know being the ATM PIN. And it is a very strong card authentication methodology underpinning it. And it's something I will refer to later. What we are doing is adopting classical RSA PKI cryptography to actually assert the authenticity of the card that's being offered up in point of sale and anywhere else. And that's really vital to us because you cannot break RSA cryptography easily, certainly not at the key length we're using, which is 1024-bit keys. And that's vital to us because it gives us some confidence that the credential cannot be cloned or copied. And we have got a robust and simple card holder verification method by using PINs. It is simple. I mean, Bill was saying that this morning. People have been using PINs on ATMs certainly at ATMs since about the mid-70s, early 70s. And everyone seems relatively comfortable with it. And it works. You have only got a 4-digit number to remember, and most people can manage that. And it's got some very elegant risk management settings. So it's a good technology. But what it isn't is a major processing platform. It's not an IBM PC, and it's certainly not a supercomputer. There is only so much you can do with it. Now, where does that fit in with biometrics? Well, first of all, we have to worry about where the PINs are going to last. And we've clearly got some of the benefits there. And the problem is there are threats out there. And that's why we're worried about what we might need to do in the future. And it's easy to compromise because of all this. It's easy to compromise because of things happening on the internet with phishing and malware, which is trying to go and get people, particularly through phishing, to offer up giving their PIN in a context where it shouldn't be given up. We haven't seen many of these directed at UK customers in the sense of phishing targeting PINs, but we certainly have from our experience in the US. And this is an example of a log file that we recovered about 4 years ago, which was nicely laid out, well-structured, and had all that sort of detail in relationship to the phishing capture that he was trying to do. So if we haven't got PINs, where do we go? Well, we've got to go to biometrics. It becomes the three-factor solution, something you know, something you have, and something you are. But if we're going to use biometrics to replace PIN, and people continually ask me why do you just go straight to biometrics, we've got to answer these sorts of technology, these sort of questions. And these are the sort of questions the business people are asking me now about whether it is ready to yet to even think about going down the biometric route. And I'll try and give you my prediction of when that will be at the end. So, first of all, which biometric are we going to choose? Well, we've all heard stories like that. I think that was where someone's fingerprint was chopped off so they could actually go and steal the Mercedes. And this worries me. Not just worries me because it's a terrible crime, but you can imagine, if we put fingerprints as the to replace the PIN on the card, is that not a case of potentially fueling crime, and particularly really severely violent crime? And what would the bank's responsibility be in that space by deploying technology which is actually putting customers in harm's way? It would take mugging to a whole new level that I don't think any of us want to go down. So that would be a problem. It's also a problem because you might not even need to mug them. What we're worried about in the UK is people actually writing their PIN numbers on the cards because we're worried they'll forget them. And seriously, some people are known to actually write their PIN number on their card. But, of course, what will be people doing if they use fingerprints as a point of detection? They'll be leaving their PIN all over the card all the time, or their replacement to the PIN. You just need to pick someone's wallet up and you could recover the fingerprint. Well, lots of people say, well, how can you recover a fingerprint? Well, it's those people who don't watch CSI Miami or CSI New York or CSI, because we see it every day on every episode, they're actually recovering fingerprints. And of course, it's now in the press. Is anyone unfamiliar with gummy fingerprints? Or you're all familiar with the gummy fingerprints phenomenon? Well, it's a wonderful story. And I don't know whether you actually read the whole article or not, but actually the process is shown here by doing the gelatine, getting an image, and so on. But what's really wonderful about it is they automated the process, if you read the article, and actually used the same techniques where you cut circuit boards to generate not just one copy of the fingerprint, but multiple copies of the fingerprint. You can have as many copies of the fingerprint as you like. It's delightful. And even some very simple descriptions elsewhere on the web. So would we use fingerprints if it's that unreliable? Particularly, you know, but we're also forced down the fingerprint route because everyone seems to think fingerprints are the biometric to use because everyone else is using them. What about standardization and interoperability? Can we do it in a standard way? Well, the first thing is we have a fingerprint. We have to compare it with something else. And the way that forensic systems tend to work is they compare them minutiae. I can never pronounce that word, if you apologize. That funny word at the top there. It means all the whorls and characteristics of the biometric. Now, if we were to take that and pass that into a chip, we need a chip with processing power beyond what we've got, with a time duration of transaction that we can't afford to try and do those matches. So what do we do instead? Well, what we do instead is we actually generate what's called a template. They actually extrapolate it, and you then go and join the little dots to create a template image of some form or other. The trouble is, all these templating systems are unique to the manufacturer who developed that templating. There isn't a standard template out there. And we always strive for interoperability. We want the same technology on the cards in UK that you have in Australia, that you have in the US. Eventually, we hope, because we hope to go down the chip card route, in France, Germany, you name it, we want it standardized. But in that case, if we went for this sort of thing, wouldn't be standardizing on a standard, we'd be standardizing on a manufacturer or developer, and that's not a safe place to be in. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, there is evidence now that actually you can reverse engineer a template to get something that looks like a valid fingerprint. Now, that's a bit of a worry, because these templates were supposed to be non-reversible. And if they start to become reversible, that opens up another future potential security weakness that we have to worry about and cover off. Terminals. How are we going to capture the fingerprints? We are deployed a million chip and PIN terminals in merchants in UK. A million plus terminals. Now, they cost of the order of about £60 to £70 a time to get your PIN numbers put in. And they're built securely and they are relatively robust. Now, if we're going to build them to the same standard and take these fingerprints in them as well, I'm pretty sure the cost of those terminals is going to be far more than most merchants are willing to pay. And that's going to be a bit of a problem. What about the accuracy of them? False error and false reject rates. You always get these standard curves, which actually represent the false non-match and false match rates. And you're always trying to get down in the middle where you're generally trying to work in the equal error rate. That's what everyone's trying to get you to do. Whereas we, from a security practitioner, want to try and stop bad guys getting in. So we're going to be trying to work over in that side of the graph. But if we do that, we're also worried about that side from a banking perspective. Because, as I said, we don't want Mr. Joe Normal to go to the supermarket on a Saturday morning to get his groceries out, put his credit card in, ask for his fingerprint, and be rejected. Because that's not a very good customer service obligation. So from our perspective, we've got to choose a biometric that gives us the right quality of performance where we're working at this end and actually stopping these number of people getting through. Because it's a security measure. We want to make sure that the criminals can't use someone else's card. It's a balance that we have to strike between these two factors. And I'm not sure yet that the technology is sufficiently mature to make that balance. On the other hand, consumers are starting to like this technology. They're actually shopping in a number of shops by using fingerprints. There's one in the States and there's a trial going on in the UK. Now, they're not using our cards because they're a closed system. The customer is enrolling their card and their personality in that shop with their fingerprint, so they actually do it that way. Interestingly, it doesn't become a valid credit card payment because it actually counts as a card not present, just like an internet payment, rather than a chip and PIN payment when they do it. And customers like it. It's actually quite good. You know, it's use and ease of convenience. Go up, put my finger in, walk away with my groceries. What could be simpler? But on the other hand, you're getting some of the down experience. This is in Schiphol Airport. And I have heard some people say, and I've got some Dutch colleagues in the audience who might know some of the stories better than I, but this iris recognition system, it's on some days, actually works so bad, you might as well actually queue with everyone else going through rather than actually going through this. Scott's shaking his head. I think it was Scott who told me all about this, wasn't it, Scott? Yeah. So, you know, that's going to actually get people a bit off this technology. And if that wasn't bad enough, media stories such as this that are coming out of the press about criminals, the Chaos Club, trying to get hold of people's fingerprints, and all this wanted advert trying to get Gordon Brown's fingerprints and the current UK Home Secretary Jackie Smith's fingerprints, you know, people are going to start to say, well, if it's easy as that, I don't trust biometrics anymore. So don't bother even trying to put biometrics on top of me, Mr. Bank, or anyone else, because it must be bad because these guys say it's bad and the media are saying it bad. So we have a tension between the user convenience and actually the angst because it's not seen to be fit for purpose. How do you capture the biometric? If you're a bank, let's suppose that we did it. All the financial institutions of the world absolutely went out and embraced fingerprint or capture or some sort of biometric technology for point of sale. Where are they going to capture your biometric from? Go into the branch? Do it in an ATM as the trial is taking place in Japan with finger vein technology? Interesting exercise. But the problem is, not all banks have ATMs. Have we ever seen a Capital One ATM? No? Well, they don't, because they're entirely an internet-based organization. We have three or four banks in UK that are solely internet-based financial institutions. They don't have a high street presence. So how can they capture anyone's biometric? That's going to be an interesting problem to resolve. Because the whole investment benefit of having a bank on the internet is you haven't got a branch, you haven't got staff, and therefore it's going to erode your business proposition. Okay, what's our estimate and gut reaction? Well, our gut reaction at the moment is that this technology is not yet mature and fit for purpose for a face-to-face verification at point of sale. And I don't think it will be for about good till about 2016 at the earliest. But these things could change. You know, let's suppose that customers really start to embrace this idea and the government ID card programs and passports and all that really captures people's imagination. We might be forced to do it earlier. Equally, we might push to do it later because the credibility has gone down. We don't know the specifics of what will happen when, but we don't think at the moment it's right yet. We actually don't even know which biometric technology we would use at point of use. My personal argument would be that looking at the sort of things that the Japanese are doing with finger vein technology. Okay, let's look at something that looks more promising. Voice-based biometrics. Voice biometrics, wonderful technology in its essence of what it's trying to do. This business that it's so natural. We use people's voice to recognize us all the time. And from a bank's perspective, it's wonderful because we offer services over the telephone. So it's actually linked in directly to that sort of approach. It's really a very exciting thing to consider. Has got some challenges. Misforgotten words and pronunciation and all these sorts of issues, and of course the worry of replay attacks. There are strategies one can follow and good practice about how you do this. And we had a seminar with our members a few weeks ago where we were looking at this in detail, and it worked. It captured people's imagination in a way I never thought it would, and it's starting to be quite an attractive way going forward. The challenge is to make sure you know what you're buying. And when you look at the vendors out there, they come up with these wonderful charts like these, which are the equal, the false accept versus the false accept versus the fault reject rate. And you should see a line like you do on that one, which is the equal error rates down the middle. You have to really look at the data in a hard way. The vendor was offering us that as a diagram, trying to show how good voice technology was, a voice vendor. This was from a diagram from a government report, which was showing all these technologies compared after four attempts, not one attempt. And, oh, by the way, that was based on a high-quality microphone, not a telephone handset. So you have to look at this data very carefully. Now, on the other hand, this one over here from British Telecom is very interesting because it's showing the graphs in relationship to known bandwidth of known voice channels. And the one at the top is the standard plain old telephone system of the telephone on your desk. That one there is the mobile phone. And you can see the level of performance is significantly worse than that one there. I'll show you what I mean by that. I've actually aggregated that data in a simpler graph. There are four sets of data there. Now, let's postulate that we want to replace voice biometrics with a technology that's as secure as a PIN. So that is the line in relationship to the chance of getting a PIN. Now, the first problem I would say is that what you need to do is look at these two data sets here. These two data sets here are the ones that relate to the voice channel over a normal telephone and over a mobile phone. So neither of them are actually approaching the scale that we would expect for the same sort of quality as a trying to guess a PIN, or same level of security as you're trying to guess a PIN. So in that sense, one would potentially argue that it's not ready for prime time. The challenge about voice biometrics is this, that it does start to offer the potential for doing things in better ways, providing you do it with a conjunction with other technology that you could deploy. Now, the last use case scenario, which I've got to quickly rush through, unfortunately, because I've run out of time as usual, is to look at the registration paradigm. Do I know you already? Because this is the other way that banks will try and exploit this technology. The registration paradigm is all about trying to understand the secure binding that might exist between people out there. And what we're trying to acknowledge here, quite overtly, is that trust is always based on three parties in the equation. There is never any trust which is based on me knowing someone who I've never met before. Someone always introduces someone to someone else. And that same analogy can take place on the internet. It can take place face-to-face transactions everywhere. And what we get from that is a much stronger binding and trust relationship between parties as they are introduced. And one of the keys to it is have the right credential that people offer as a way of extending that referential trust when that third party isn't present. So when I go into a shop with my credit card, it's got Visa and MasterCard on it, which is extending the trust of those payment systems to the merchant so he knows he's going to get a secure payment in the end. And biometrics have a really strong role to play in the issue of the registration paradigm. So what do I mean by that? Someone goes into a financial institution, they offer some credentials up. Those credentials were provided by someone. I'm not worried who they are at the moment. It could be anyone. The first thing we have to ask ourselves is, do I trust the issuing authority of those credentials? If it's government, I might do. If it's a utility company, well, I might do in UK, but other places I might not. Were those credentials issued to that person? And can I prove that he actually is the person, correct person to present those credentials? And that's the sort of problem we have to operate in response to a weak registration and enrollment paradigm that we have at the moment. Because I would argue there is what I call a circularity of trust. And this is quite complex, so I'll try and work through this slowly. But if someone is issued some credentials from a bank, like a Visa or a card or a MasterCard, it'll go to another financial institution, it'll be recognized, not a problem. And you can go to another financial institution, it'll be recognized around the world. And there is a nice degree of circularity there, but it's a circularity of a closed loop, so it's not a problem. The challenge is, how do you get those credentials in the first place? So you've got to open an account. In UK, one of the things you can do is take along a utility bill. Now, how many people think a utility bill is a dozy way of actually doing anything? Well, there is actually a bit of logic behind it, because what they're trying to use the utility bill is to secure a secure binding of where that person lives with the person presenting themselves. And the reason they can do it is that every single, in the case of electricity meter, every single electricity meter in UK is tied to a specific address. And if someone comes along with enough credentials, we can start to develop a biographical footprint of where they live. So you've got that. You've got the government credential as well. The trouble is, the utility account that that person is presenting is based on the fact that they've got an account which can pay the utility bill. The government credential that you're offered, the passport, is actually based on the fact that the government can establish a biographical footprint by the fact that you've got a utility account with a bank account, and you've got a good bank account because it's actually registered with the credit reference agency. So around that, you've got what I would call a circle of trust, not a hierarchy. And if you break that circle anywhere, you have a problem. And that's one of the reasons we have identity fraud at the levels we have around the world. They're everywhere is relying on this circle of trust, which is broken by the attackers wherever they actually interpose themselves. So what we're trying to do is support the government with good arguments, because we strongly believe that establishing a gold standard of identity and an identity route is critical. And let's see how that could work. And here we've got someone going to the government. And the government's got its own systems, its own databases. And you can turn up to the government and you can offer some of the credentials that you've got. Birth certificate, for example. And the government can check that birth certificate quite legitimately. You might be able to offer them some other credentials, like, for example, a bank account or something like that. And they can check that online with credit reference agencies to check that you have an account and that you are a good credit, not your credit rating, but you are who you say you are by virtue of that. And all that's trying to do is establish a biographical footprint for that individual out there in society. They can also take your fingerprint. And what they're doing now, and this is why biometrics are so important, they can check you on that database to check they don't know those details against anyone else on that database. It makes sure that you have got one person who has those credentials, and you can register all the rest of the biographical stuff alongside the fingerprint on that database to try and record a secure binding between that individual and his place on the registry, on the database. And doing so, you can generate a token that you can give him, a token that is secure, that he can then offer when he goes to locations to actually present that when he wants to do some services or goods with someone, a relying party. Providing these two facts are acknowledged. Firstly, that a person is only registered once, therefore a person has only one card. And secondly, it's important that the card cannot be cloned or duplicated in any way. Therefore, a card can only be ever with one person. If those two facts can be made to be true, and we believe they can if the appropriate technology is chosen, then we have got a good, strong binding between the registration on the database and the credential and that individual. such that when I come across to be the relying party, I can actually prove the credential is genuine. I can prove that the person is bound to that credential, and I can then actually offer goods and services to them. Now, when it comes to registration paradigm and the use of biometrics in this space, we believe that biometrics are ready for use. Fingerprints, iris, all this technology can help people strongly register people and deduplicate entries in the database to make sure that there aren't two people, two Colin Whittakers, on that database. Yes, we recognise it can only be done in controlled and managed conditions, and that's where we want it done, because we want it done to a gold standard. We want good quality registration with people checking people's palms to make sure there's no gummy fingerprints stuck on them or anything else. We think biometrics are going to be a major component of any and all national ID card programs going in the future. And in fact, we've got it already, because that's why we put faces on passports, for goodness sake. So it's something that we shouldn't be afraid of or ashamed of. Now, we in the industry, our industry, which is where everyone's being defrauded from, are going to find these sorts of criteria very important in the future going forward to make sure that we can bind people to the bank accounts that they are issued and making sure that we reduce the level of fraud. We actually think that the level of fraud would fall by up to about 50 to 75% if we can rely on the credentials and bind people to those credentials that they are issued with. Okay, so in summary, biometrics are maturing fast. They are a good technology if they're used the right way for the right purpose. Now, from our perspective, fitting those technologies to the purposes where it really matters. And I had actually argued that what I argued here is a plausible scenario for three use case scenarios where we can and cannot use biometrics. And from our perspective, we like biometrics in the sense of voice biometrics for telephones, because that offers some advantages and can complement what we're doing. It's certainly ready for the registration paradigm, and we want that as soon as possible so we can have customers present good and valid credentials that they can be bound to in a secure binding when they come to get goods and services from us. But don't expect people to biometrically verify themselves at point of use anytime soon with anything other than the face on the passport. This idea of people going up and presenting their fingerprints for point of sale and trying to use that as a secure binding is not going to happen anytime soon. Thank you. Thank you.